From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Joe Sciacca is leaving the Boston Herald. He reflects with us.
It's important that some stories be told, even if they offend. You know, there used to be a slogan that we used to the Herald that was, somebody's got to say it.
Also today, we talked to the head of the state's Office of Campaign and Political Finance, who is stepping down after 25 years on the job.
I officiate high school football, soccer, and baseball. It's the exact same job. You call balls and strikes, and you use common sense.
And the quest begins to turn me into a hockey fan. This Bruins team just might do it.
Pastrnak by one. Pastrnak fed it over. McCreevy scores! They've done it again in overtime.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. For nearly a decade, Joe Sciacca has led the Boston Herald, most recently seeing it through a change in ownership and massive layoffs. But today, after more than 30 years of working at the daily newspaper, Sciacca announced he's leaving the Herald for the role of enterprise editor at Channel 7 News. He joined us earlier today to talk about his next move and reflect on his tenure at the Herald.
If the Herald were a person that you knew, you know, it would be if it was an organic creature, it would be somebody that was stood up for the little guy, you know, that was populist, that had was easily outraged by injustice, was outraged by government abuse, you know, that wanted to help people and start the conversation every day. So every day that front page was a blank canvas, and I knew that as a writer, when I was a young 26-year-old reporter, walking into that building for the first time, that I could write something, and then when those presses started to roll and you could smell the ink and the floor was vibrating and you saw those papers shooting out the door, that it was going to have impact the next day. Maybe it was going to result in a government reform. Maybe it would help somebody. Maybe it would help somebody that otherwise would not be given any attention until the spotlight of the press was on them. So I think that helping people and telling stories that can achieve something in the public interest, that's kind of what I'm interested in doing.
I'm curious. I mean, that is an impassioned description of what you've been trying to accomplish at the Herald for the last 30 years. Did you think originally that you would retire in print journalism?
Well, when newspapers loomed large and we were ruling the universe, we knew nothing except print, and we thought that there could never be an end to newspapers. But then when the internet happened, we realized that there was going to be disruption. But, you know, I have always felt that disruption was a good thing because it brought innovation and it brought creativity. It made us think about our business in a different way, and it made us think about how we communicate in different ways. And so I embraced it, and I embrace it today, and I think it was a good thing for journalism. I think journalism is alive and well.
So I want to stay with this idea of disruption, Joe. I mean, the Herald has been greatly disrupted. You know, there's been a series of cascading events there, starting with publisher Pat Purcell announcing the sale of the paper, Digital First Media's acquisition. Then there were layoffs, cuts. Did that affect your decision to leave and go into a different branch of journalism?
Newspapers are challenged. Like, I'm a realist. There's no doubt about it. And so there are lots of things that I might have been able to do 20 years ago that I can't do today because of financial constraints and resources that are tighter. And that's the same at any newspaper in the country. We're seeing the same sort of financial challenges and the tightening. And it's very discouraging and very disheartening, no doubt about it. But to me, honestly, every day that the Herald is published is a win. It's a win for Boston. It's a win for the readers. And so I'm somebody who, as an advocate for journalism, you know, whatever it takes to keep that paper afloat, I'm going to support it. Producing news is very expensive. Paying reporters and photographers and editors and the distribution systems and the printing systems, and then of course all of the web digital systems that we have in place today. It's very expensive to run a newsroom, and so a lot of difficult decisions have to be made. I look at the positive signs. I look at digital subscriptions growing, and I see that as being a big plus. I see the print readers hanging on because they want that product. There are still readers that want that print product. I think that it's really about multimedia and trying to produce content for use across platforms that's unique, that's high-quality content. And I think that's the challenge for the media today, is to try to create that content that you could only get under the umbrella of your brand. And in the Herald's case, I think we've done a very good job of preserving that brand, that populist, fighting for the little guy, government watchdog, feisty kind of brand.
That kind of brand, if that kind of voice goes away, whether it's just imprint or overall, what's lost in a local community like Boston?
Well, Boston is very, very fortunate to have two daily newspapers that are still out there every day. I have a lot of friends at the Boston Globe. And as much as I root for the Herald's success every day, I root for the Globe's success every day. I think we have a great dynamic in Boston with two major daily papers. And if you stop reading one of those papers in a given week, you're going to miss stories. You're not going to see them anywhere else. And so part of the city really does go silent when one of those papers ceases to exist. And we've seen that happen in so many other places in the country. We don't want it to happen here. So I just think it's imperative that we do whatever we can to try to keep those voices alive. Now, whether those voices will always be alive in print or whether they will be digital or some other means of communication, the bottom line, I think, is that you always need good reporters, you always need good editors, you'll always need people presenting the content, curating the content, and I think that's what's really important.
Let's stick with this idea of voice for a minute, Joe. A couple of times during this discussion, you've used the word populist. You've talked about the Herald pushing back on government corruption, or I think one phrase you used was easily outraged by injustice. So how do you characterize the Herald's voice? And what about critics who say, oh, you've pushed pretty hard and you've offended people and made people angry with that outrage and that populist voice editorially, let's say, over the last 10 years?
Well, I think that it's important that some stories be told, even if they offend. And I think that, there used to be a slogan that we used to the Herald that was, somebody's got to say it. And sometimes we'd write stories that we knew that weren't going to be the most popular, that perhaps there'd be pushback. And I think that you can't be dissuaded by that when you're a journalist. You've got to tell the story as you know it. I just know that when I look back on some of the great things that we've done in recent years, special reports about teenage homelessness, finding out that there are thousands of kids that go to Boston Public Schools that are homeless, an amazing statistic, and drilling down on that in a two-day special report followed up with a roundtable discussion. Human trafficking and the intersection with opioid abuse, we wrote a special report about that and sort of looked at the new issue, the new challenges that law enforcement and others in government face in dealing with that dangerous intersection of human trafficking and opioid abuse. Unsolved murders. We looked at statistics in Boston Police Department. And we found that there were hundreds of unsolved murders and that the majority of those unsolved murders took place in Boston's minority neighborhoods, and that the majority of the victims of unsolved murders were young black men. And there was the question raised, it was an uncomfortable question. Were the police just assuming that those cases were gang-related and therefore not quite putting the resources into it, into solving those crimes? They weren't easy stories to tell. They might have offended some people. They might have been provocative, but they had to be told, and the Herald told them. So I'm proud of that.
When you started that answer, you said somebody's got to say it. We are in a time where there's a lot of quote-unquote speaking your mind that can really enter into the realm of being offensive. Does somebody always have to say it, or how do you think about those editorial judgments in doing your work?
Well, I'm a little old school when it comes to objectivity. I still believe that, and I still tell our reporters, even if you believe something to be the case, that you need to be fair, you need to have some balance in a story. Today, I think that objectivity is very, very much endangered. It's one thing to tell a story with passion and to tell a story that has a strong, conclusive point, But it's another thing to basically not tell the other side or to not frame the story as a discussion. And I think that even today in journalism schools, there are some journalism professors that are telling students, look, you know, you don't have to get the other side. If you have a premise and you believe it to be true, you gather the facts that back up that premise, and that's your narrative. I don't agree with that.
So let's talk about your change now. You're moving from print journalism to television. Why did that move make sense to you? What does the venue or the medium of television particularly offer you at this stage in your career?
I like the real-time aspect of TV. I like the fact that things are being reported as they happen. And certainly now with social media, there's a real-time element to what we do. I like the visual impact of television, but also learning how to tell stories in a different way, to tell stories in a visual way, and to tell stories in a high-impact way.
It's pretty striking that Channel 7 is an independent television station and the Herald was established and run for a very long time as an independent paper. Do you see parallels there, and how do you think about those?
You know, I think so. I mean, I think that there's a certain, whether it's a, you know, being hungry for the news or having this sort of feeling that you're sort of untethered, that you can go out there and cover anything anyway without being beholden to anyone. I think there is a certain element to that. Channel 7 has done a remarkable job, you know, in terms of staying very relevant in this market. And let's be honest, television is challenged as well. I mean, every medium is challenged in today's changing media environment where people are getting news in so many different ways. And so it's imperative that TV tells continues to try to tell stories in the highest impact way possible so that they can remain relevant. And that involves a lot of listening to what people are talking about out there and to finding what the audience is and then speaking to that audience.
Joe, what's the legacy that you hope you're leaving behind at the Boston Herald?
Well, I'll tell you, for me, it's, and I don't want to sound like too old of a person here, but I mean, I look back on the young reporters that I worked with over the years. I look at Kimberly Atkins, you know, who I hired to be a City Hall reporter and a State House reporter at the Herald years ago. Worked with her for many years, a brilliant reporter, and now she's at WBUR doing great and just actually communicating with her today. I look at Carolyn Ryan, who I hired from the Patriot Ledger and covered the State House for us. Spent a couple of years with us, went to the Globe for some time, and now she's at the New York Times doing really, really well. So it's the impact that I hope I've had on journalists as they were learning the business and doing great work, and whether they stayed at the paper for many, many years like me or whether they went on to other things. That's what I think I take the greatest pride in.
Joe Sciacca has been the editor of the Boston Herald since 2010. He announced today that he's leaving for a new job as enterprise editor at Channel 7 News. Joe, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Eugene. I appreciate it.
So let's get some analysis. We're joined here in Studio 3 by WBUR senior news analyst John Carroll. John also blogs at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Seems like a really good day to have the guy whose blog is called It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. You know, I just going to start. I watched you listening to that. So let me ask, just start with your reactions to what you heard Joe say about why he's leaving.
Well, I think the Herald is lucky to be alive. And I think Joe Sciacca has a good deal to do with that. I mean, this is a hard town to be a tabloid in. You know, the three C's, crime, celebrity, corruption, you know, we're not great on any of them, actually. I don't want to downplay crime or anything, but I mean, you look at a paper like the New York Post. I mean, you know, that has a really highly tabloid sensibility. The Herald has kind of been in this sort of mid-range for a while. And I think that Joe Sciacca has done a good job of keeping the paper relevant with dwindling resources.
You know, you used the word tabloid a couple times. The Globe today referred to the Herald as a scrappy tabloid. What do we mean by tabloid, and what is the market in print journalism that a tabloid fills?
Well, I mean, tabloid refers to the physical layout of the paper. You know, the Globe's a broadsheet, the Herald's a tabloid. But there's also a sensibility that you know, you're going out there, and like Joe says, you know, you want basically the scrappy reputation and scrappy image that you're out there fighting writing for regular people. You know, the Herald has always been that sort of paper. Its circulation is dwindling fast. I mean, you know, Joe talked about 20 years ago. You know, 20 years ago, the Herald circulation was 261,000 a day. You know, now it's somewhere around 38,000. So, you know, it's hard to keep going when you've got to basically sell yourself off the newsstand every day, which is what the Herald has to do.
So for people who were not here during the height of the Two Daily Town, when the Herald was bigger and stronger than it is now, help people understand, what was that like? What was different about then now? And what are we running the risk of losing?
There was an edgier competition back then. I mean, the Herald has always had a chip on its shoulder and has always gone out there to try to compete with the Globe. I used to think of the Herald as sort of a lively index to the Globe, but really they live in completely different universes now, and there's not all that much intersection. Maybe sports is the basic area, but the Herald is really finding its own way and doing stories that other people that the Globe is not doing. So today they have a story about EBT cards, the welfare cards being used in Hawaii. You know, that's a classic kind of Herald story. And, you know, that's what they've provided all along.
So one might intuitively think, okay, Herald gets smaller, good for the Boston Globe. But is there a way in which a smaller other paper is bad for a paper like the Globe?
Well, the Globe is much smaller, too. I mean, if you want comparables, in 2003, the Globe circulated 402,000 papers a day. You know, now they're around 100,000. So, you know, they've been cut 75% in their circulation. So both papers are struggling in terms of circulation. But the Globe sees itself with a different mission than the Herald. And they also have different revenue models. When I say the Herald has to sell itself off the newsstand every day, that's literally true because they have very few home subscribers. So every day they have to go out there and, you know, put out a paper that is going to attract people to pick it up and pay for it on their way to the tea, on their, you know, on their way to lunch, whatever it might be. So that's difficult, and that sets up a sort of a different editorial kind of sensibility than if you're the Globe, which has a lot of home subscribers and doesn't have to worry about newsstand sales quite as much as the Herald does.
So let's use that EBT story as an example of something. Joe talked about the importance of balance and presenting both sides. You know, in the EBT story, yes, there were some expenditures in Hawaii, but it was an extremely small percentage, and people are allowed to be other places. So when we have that desire for balance, do we always present the picture the way it is, or are we pushing things for editorial agendas?
Yeah, all due respect to Joe. I mean, the whole idea of balance, you know, his paper is basically a Trump organ at this point. Almost every columnist is a card-carrying Trumpiac. You know, there's very little diversity in terms of perspective, in terms of ideology, in terms of Even racial diversity at the paper. And they have an agenda that they're carrying out day after day after day, which is to promote Donald Trump, his administration, and the kinds of policies that they think will play with their audience.
Do you think Joe would take issue with that characterization?
Joe would take issue with almost everything I say.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, that's we go back a fair amount.
All right. So let's talk about whether and if this is a harbinger, this move of the editor of the Boston Herald to a television news station is a harbinger of larger things for local print journalism.
Well, I mean, you have to look at the ownership of the Herald. The Digital First Media came in and bought the Herald, and they have a reputation of basically stripping down all their properties. They've stripped the Herald down. They came in with 175 employees. They're now down around 100. So essentially, they're going to milk the Herald for as much as they can. That's not good news for anybody who's there or for the resources that they might have going forward.
In our last 30 seconds or so, is this the beginning of the end of the Boston Herald?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's remarkable that they get the paper out every day. And I think that they're down to bare bones. And the question is there going to be some kind of regionalization of Digital First Media papers? You know, they own the Lowell Sun. They own the Fitchburg Sentinel Enterprise. you know, that might happen. I wouldn't write off the Herald anytime soon.
All right. WBUR senior news analyst John Carroll, also a blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we talk to the head of the state's Office of Campaign and Political Finance, who is stepping down after 25 years on the job. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. For the past 25 years, Michael Sullivan has been making sure politicians, campaigns, and advocacy groups play by the rules as the head of the State Office of Campaign and Political Finance. He'll be stepping down after the new year. He's here now in Studio 3 to talk with us about his six terms as the office's director and the trends in campaign finance going forward. Mike, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Six terms is a lot.
Feels like I've been there forever.
Yeah. Listen, politics is arguably a different beast than it was six terms ago in the mid-1990s. What's the most different, do you think, about the office now than when you started it 25, when you started in it 25 years
ago? Within the office itself, electronic filing and the speed at which we do things.
So what does that look like?
Well, when I started, if you wanted to see a report or you wanted to see what a candidate was doing, you had to come to our office and, you know, ask to see the file. Now you sit at home and click on your computer and there it is all in living color as soon as it's filed by the candidate.
So it used to be physically people were there and now do you not see anyone?
The day when reports were due, the line out the door was hilarious because every reporter in town wanted to see the report first. Frank Phillips would be in there and he'd be fighting with Shaka, trying to figure out who was, you know, going to get the story out first.
So has that made other things possible for your office to do that it used to not have time and resources to do? Or is managing the digitization of all of this just a different set of responsibilities?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think what has happened with electronic filing and the software that we've built in-house is that we've been able to notice trends. It's helped us with investigations. We've done a tremendous amount of investigations, and they know about it here, on dark money. Where's the money really coming from? Or funneled money with straw donors. So it's helped us manage our expectations and what we do. It's helped us educate candidates because people have moved into the digital world. And it's made the job a lot more interesting, actually.
What's more interesting about it to you now than, let's say, five terms ago?
The ability to understand what's really going on in real time, instead of waiting until after everything is over and then analyzing everything on paper and looking for trends. When reports come in now or the questions that we get now, we keep a phone log of our questions so I understand what the issues are and what kind of advice we're giving out. It makes it so much smoother to understand everything and so much quicker. And we see trends across the country. We see them here early, dark money early here.
So let's stay on that for a second. You came on Radio Boston a couple years ago to discuss a record fine that your office leveled against a pro-charter school group. As I understand it, that fine remains the largest in state history. How do you reflect on that now?
Good work by our audit department, sitting down and looking at the reports that were filed and not understanding why a 501c4 was able to funnel that much money to a ballot question committee, that there had to be something behind it. And we used the techniques that we developed over the years and the subpoena power that we had, and we were able to pull it all together and figure out who the people were behind the money. And I think that's what the voters deserve to know. People should know who's funding the candidates' campaigns. That's what we are there for. We are there for disclosure and we are there for education and to help people understand the statute, get people to run, you know, by making sure they understand what they're supposed to do. And you put all of that together, it was really an abomination to see. I don't even know how many millions of dollars were going through there. But it was frustrating to me as a voter, as an individual, and as the head of an agency, that nobody was behind this money because we knew somebody was.
So who was and how big was the fine?
A lot of major names that people in the financial world would recognize. Some people within the administration at the time were contributors as well. I honestly, if you ask me right now, I couldn't tell you their names because
that's
once
right.
It's
gave
done,
us
it's
types
done.
Of names.
It's sort of like when I officiate a football game.
Yeah.
It's the blue team and the red team, and when it's over, I can't remember who did what.
We do know that there were two Baker administration appointees,
yeah.
And I think the fine was northward of $400,000.
Yeah, well, it was every penny they had left in their campaign account.
So I want to ask, a fine of that size, do you think it's had lasting effect? Does that have the kind of chilling effect that you want on future behavior by other organizations that get involved in ballot initiatives, campaign initiatives?
There's no doubt in my mind that it had a chilling effect and B, an educational effect. And in the next set of ballot questions in 2018, in which a lot of money was spent, remember the healthcare question, the nurses question, a lot of money was spent on that. And the amount of questions that we got from people about what needs to be reported, how do we disclose this, how do we do this, we want to make sure we do it right. Because I have a saying that I use in the office is that 95% of the people who are involved in politics want to do it right and can. 2 or 3% want to do it right, need a little help, and 2 or 3% want to mess around a little bit. So our job is to help 97% of the people, and I think we did a good job.
So that ballot question would have mandated nurse staffing ratios, and the spending was over $24 million, almost $25 million mm-hmm. spent. So do you feel pretty confident that that money was spent appropriately, transparently, legally?
I do.
And is it hard with a – I mean, that was the biggest ever. Mm-hmm. It will the office be challenged going forward to keep up with the rate and pace of spending and keep it clean, for lack of a better word?
Oh, I have no doubt. I have no doubt. You know, we have a great staff, tremendous staff, a good audit department, good legal department. But they will be challenged. We're challenged every day. New law just came in that I've been pushing for 8 years on how candidates for the legislature and certain mayoral candidates have to file their reports. And it's going to be more accurate and the disclosure is going to be quicker and it's going to be cleaner. And so there's going to be some challenges in that regard in doing the transition. There's going to be some challenges in where the money comes from. I mean, I read today, I don't even remember the name of the group, but there's another ballot question coming where they had 87,000 signatures filed yesterday. So we know that that's going to continue to come down the road. And the interesting thing with ballot questions, there are no limits. Anybody, any entity can give. It just has to be disclosed.
Yeah, and I do want to clarify that nearly $25 million was spent by one side. It was just the defeat side with that ballot initiative. So we are talking about breathtaking scale mm-hmm. of money. So how would you say – all right, let me backtrack and say this. We are certainly living in a time where there's a constant concern and awareness about the quality, fairness, legality of elections. We hear about it a lot.
We do.
So how well do you think Massachusetts stacks up around the country in this space?
So this is the blow my own horn toot?
You go for it.
Okay. I think we stack up very well. We go to a national conference, which is in a couple of weeks this year in Chicago, and people are always talking to us about how we're able to do what we do in terms of the cases that we close. And one of the greatest things about this agency is the way the director is selected. It's the director is independent. The person is selected in a bipartisan fashion. They give the term for 6 years, and essentially the people who choose you go away. They trust you to do your job. And with that kind of freedom and the integrity within my office, I think we've done a really good job, and we're able to make sure that the public understands what it is that candidates should do.
So that almost changed. A bill that passed last month in one of its earlier versions would have done away with that particular system of appointing you. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you feel it's important to preserve that kind of approach to appointing the director.
I do think that whatever the decision is that they make, and that's the decision of the legislature, the person who has the job has to have that independence level to do the job correctly. And I will say this, and you know, the legislature takes its share of hits. Every single time from 1994 on that I went over there to ask for additional funding for whatever I needed, we were granted that money.
Why?
Every single time.
Why do you think that is?
I would hope that they trust what we do is done with integrity, is done for the betterment of politics in general, for candidacies, for elections. I mean, some things as simple as back in the old days when we had a lot of paper, I remember going over to a state rep from Salem and saying, hey, we need a new filing system. And they granted it. And then when it came time to do the electronic filing and we needed all the hardware for computers and software, they were able to give us the money. And there was never a second thought. They never blinked.
Let's compare and contrast that to where we are at the national level. The Federal Election Commission right now has 3 vacancies. That means it has 3 active members only.
Yeah, I keep waiting for that call.
Yeah. All right. You heard it here first, listeners. But I do want to ask you, why is that the case? And how big of a deal is it from a practical perspective that half that, you know, commission is vacant?
Oh, it's a huge mess.
Why?
It's just a mess.
What's going on there?
Well, the first problem is that the commission is set up to deadlock. There's 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans, or no more than 3 from one political party. And so if you've got someone on one side of the ledger, whichever one it might be, who really doesn't want to enforce the statute, you can get a deadlock every time because you need four votes to move forward. The system there, they might need an odd number if they're going to go to the voting system. I don't think the system that we have works on a national level because we're much smaller. But the way it's working right now, it's not.
So that's important because we're right around the corner from presidential 2020. What are the kinds of things that the FEC should be doing and can't do when it's hobbled this way?
Well, I mean, today I read that Duncan Hunter pled guilty to serious campaign crimes using his campaign for personal use.
Out of California.
Out of California. And that's the kind of thing, the kind of enforcement that the commission could be doing with the cases. Instead, DOJ is bringing them up because the FEC is stuck. They could be doing a lot more at the commissioner level. I'm sure the staff is doing the work, but in order to open up a case, you need to have a vote from the commission to do so. So the staff can recommend it, but if there's no one to vote, then you're basically hamstrung.
So let's stay at the national level a minute longer, because next month marks the 10th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, which essentially allowed unlimited election spending by corporations and unions. I want to know, what do you think has changed most in campaigns and elections in the decades since that ruling? And I wonder if you think it's had an effect in Massachusetts particularly.
I think the sheer amount of money that's involved and the corporations that are involved that weren't previously involved, they sort of saw that as a hands-off. And when Citizens United came down, the doors just blew open and the floodgates opened and people were able to spend – or corporations were able to spend as much as they wanted to. Initially here, I thought we would see it at the local level. I really thought that there would be an instance where like a developer of a small company was upset with a local candidate and decided to throw $10,000 into the city council race and beat that person. That didn't happen. It happened – we saw a lot of money in the mayoral race in 2013 for the mayor of Boston. And then we started to see the 527 Republican Governors Association show up. And 527s are entities that are able to receive corporate donations. And then the 527 decides where to spend the money. And it's not raised specifically for one candidacy. So once those floodgates opened and the money started to flow, it really came. I mean, we were drenched.
So the big races.
The big races now.
So what do you think are the biggest trends in campaign finance and spending that, you know, the average voter here in the Commonwealth should be aware of going forward?
Dark money. Know where the money's coming from. Know what candidates are out there and what they're doing. Where is their funding coming from? And it's hard to do because people want to hide the money. That's what everyone talks about. You know, who's supporting these people? You see those grainy ads, you know, and it's people for good government. Well, who is that? Well, we're not going to tell you our donors because we didn't use the magic words that said support or oppose. We use things like candidate X is a bad person. Call candidate X and tell him to be a good person. Well, when you don't use those magic words, you generally don't have to say who the donors are.
And so you think there's a loophole there that people need to pay attention to.
Oh, there are huge loopholes everywhere.
So I know you mentioned earlier some refereeing, and you do referee high school sports games. I think that's kind of a love of yours, right?
Oh, it's great. I've been doing it for 35 years.
So are there parallels between what you do for fun and what you do for work?
Every day. And I'll tell you, the biggest one is common sense. And I'll give you an example. In football, if you run sweep right and the left tackle holds, it generally doesn't have any effect on the play, so let's use common sense. The term we use is CSO, common sense officiating. We have a similar term here when we get complaints. And we got a complaint the other day that somebody should be fined because they told people to bring a plate of cookies to an event. We call it MEGA. It means make it go away.
Common sense officiating.
We try it.
So what are you going to do in your retirement?
Officiate.
Officiate.
actually, I might do a little consulting. We'll see. Maybe the FEC will call. I'm dead serious about that. That's someplace I'd like to go.
All right. I am paying attention to the fact that you just said that. That is Mike Sullivan, outgoing director of the State Office of Campaign and Political Finance. Mike, I appreciate you being here. Thanks.
Thank you.
Twenty years ago today, a fire in a vacant storage building in Worcester claimed the lives of six firefighters. The cold storage fire resonated around the country, leading to new protocols for fighting fires and rallying Worcester residents around the department. To mark the anniversary, WBUR's Simone Rios has this report on how the cold storage fire is remembered in Worcester today.
It's a lazy Sunday morning inside Union Station in the center of Worcester. But at one end, a crowd of people is lined up to see a special exhibit commemorating the Worcester Six.
I guess 20 years is the time to break all this stuff out again and show the people, and the people still support us. We'll never forget these guys.
Angelo Bongiovio was a Worcester firefighter from 1983 to 2011. He's here at the Worcester Historical Fire Society's exhibit to greet visitors and answer their questions. The room is filled with posters made by school kids thanking the department, patches and caps sent in from firefighters around the country, and memorabilia salvaged from the burnt ruins of the cold storage building. Bon Jovio walks toward an old pair of firefighter gloves used in the blaze, framed with the pictures of the six who gave their lives: Thomas Spencer, Paul Brotherton, Timothy Jackson, Jeremiah Lucy, James Lyons, Joseph McGuirk.
Came on the job with Paul. Jerry, out of training, came to the Providence Street Fire Station. Tommy, I worked with, great guy. Jay, I didn't know as much. Joe McGuirk, I knew his wife very well and his family that he grew up with. And, of course, Timmy, yeah, I knew them all. Fantastic people. Heroes.
Investigators found that the fire was started accidentally by two homeless people squatting in the vacant warehouse. Firefighters entered the building after hearing there may have been people inside. That turned out to be false. The labyrinthian layout and the lack of windows left the rescuers disoriented and calling for help. Fire Lieutenant John Sullivan was among those who went in to search for them. He says the rescue was particularly difficult because commanders didn't know where to send the teams. It was only after the fire that they learned which floor the trapped firefighters were on and how close they were.
We actually got called to the fifth floor, so we were on the right floor. But at that point, conditions were such that leaving the stairwell was not tenable. We were actually at that point going for ladder two. We were on the stairwell trying to sound for them to get them out. And as we were doing that, the chief called for the evacuation of the building.
Sullivan is now the fire chief in Brookline. He says the cold storage fire was the defining event in his career, taking him around the country and beyond to participate in seminars on firefighter safety and well-being.
Personally, it's been a huge burden for many years for me. I've tried to hold it up as best as I can for my family and for the firefighters around me. In my personal times, I've had my moments.
The cold storage fire investigation resulted in a series of recommendations to try to prevent firefighters from getting lost in burning buildings. They include attaching ropes to entry points, setting up high-powered lights, and using thermal imaging cameras to spot victims. But events in Worcester over the last 20 years show that no matter what kind of protocols or equipment are in use, it will always be a dangerous job. Three Worcester firefighters have been killed in the line of duty since the cold storage blaze. Most recently, Lieutenant Jason Menard, who died last month after entering a burning building. It's Sunday at the Worcester Flea Market, and vendor Susan Mastro-Mateo swipes her cell phone as she ticks off prices to customers. I stopped in here to see how ordinary Worcester residents feel about the cold storage fire 20 years later. Mastro Mateo says it's never far from her mind.
Knew most of them. Sorry, this is hot. So we knew most of them. One was my nephew's father's, was the kid's friends. We used to see him all the time at Toscano's Market. So we knew a lot of them. Nobody in Worcester doesn't not know anybody. Does somebody know somebody?
Right.
So we, it's hot.
One of Mastro Mateo's nephews is a firefighter, another nephew is a police officer, and she says it's the bravery of the city's first responders that inspires young people to serve. Thousands of people are expected to gather this evening at the site of the cold storage fire, where a new fire station now stands, to remember the six men who gave their lives to keep others safe.
That report from WBUR's Simone Rios. Stay with us. There is more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and my next guest has a mission to make me a hockey fan.
It's going to happen.
So let's get right into it. Let's give it a shot. We're going to check the score with Chris Siderick. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so you have been telling me for months now that you are going to turn me into a Bruins fan. Go for it.
Well, first of all, you're from Michigan, so it's kind of blasphemy that you're not into hockey anyway, right? Isn't that kind of a big thing?
Well, when
I
was a kid, as a girl, you didn't get to play ice hockey. You played floor hockey. So
I mean,
that childhood connection just wasn't there.
So, all right, fair enough, I guess. But the bottom line is this is a truly exciting team. And if you remember, at the very beginning of the season, we checked in on the Bruins.
We did.
And I was a little hesitant. You could hear it in my voice.
You said you were a jilted lover.
Yes, that's what it feels like. It feels like a scorned lover. And that is is because this team went so deep last year. They went to a Game 7 in the Stanley Cup Finals, which is such a brutal grind. It's 24 games, and it's basically a month of you play a game, you have a day to recover, and then you have to do it again the next night. And it was exhausting as a fan watching those games.
You are
never
not
mind
selling
playing.
Me.
Well, so here is where this team has been so impressive, because they have come out to a red-hot start this year, and they had every reason not to. They should have come out sluggish, and you would think eventually maybe they put it together. But there was no hangover. These guys came out red-hot. They went 3-1 their first four games, and they haven't looked back since. I just think it is a really exciting team. They've got the best record in the NHL right now. They look like they could be making another run, which nobody expected, really.
Okay, so I'm going to get in huge trouble for this on social media, but I'm going to say this to you now. If I want to see a fight, I will go to a fight. If I want to watch a sport, I want to watch the sport. And instead, a fight keeps breaking out. And it is a hard sport to follow if you haven't been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, so there's two components there, obviously. Let's talk about the fighting first, because I do think that hockey obviously has a reputation as a brutal sport, a violent sport. And fighting was a big part of the game for a long time. That has started to change a little bit. Makes a little sense if you think about hockey was a sport that didn't have a lot of rules, and so you kind of needed the fighting. You needed the enforcer on the team to basically keep the other guys in check. Otherwise, they're going to take a run at your best player to try to knock him out of the game without any fear of any kind of revenge coming back at them. So you needed that presence, right? It's similar if you think about baseball. Sometimes pitchers throw at a guy, right? And
that I do understand.
That's an unwritten rule in baseball that it's part of the game, and that's dangerous. That's violent. But anyway, hockey has been trying to get rid of fighting. I thought it was interesting. After you mentioned that fighting was one of your concerns, I looked it up. In 2008, there were 0.6 fights per game. Last year, there were 0.18 fights per game. So that is a large decrease in terms of how many fights are actually happening. You look at the Olympics, there's no fighting allowed in the Olympics. You look at the junior levels of hockey USA, no fighting. So that is having a trickle-up effect. And teams are basically kind of going all in on speed and skill. And they basically are saying, we don't want to spend the roster spot on a goon who's just going to skate around and try to punch somebody in the face.
Okay, so let's talk about this speed and skill thing. Because I have to admit, you are moving me on the fighting thing with the data. I do admit. But on the speed and skill thing, I don't know how to appreciate it. It's a hard game to see if you don't know it well.
It totally is. And you're not alone there. I think a lot of people have. And if you think back to the 90s, there was the kind of the laser highlighted puck going around to try to help people follow
that
the action.
Like, astral
it was horrible.
Tail,
it was absolutely horrible. But now that we have HDTVs and the picture's a little better, I think you can see the puck. And it's more about, okay, why are guys where they are and the positioning? But I want to draw attention to a clip that I actually tweeted at you over
you
the
did.
Weekend because I thought you would really appreciate it. David Pastrnak passed to David Krejci for a goal. It led to the overtime win against the Rangers on Friday. Here's what it sounded like.
Pastrnak by one. Pastrnak fed it off over Krejci. They've done it again in overtime.
So first of all, I got to say, you got to go to a Bees game, because if you're in the building when that horn goes off and that place is rocking, there is nothing.
I'm
like
in
it.
Here going, wah!
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't
it's
even
contagious.
Watch the game. Yes.
So, but you saw that play, and that was a pretty intentional pass, right? Pastrnak skates past the goal. Brings two defenders with him, turns around, hits the Krejci.
No,
Krejci goes top shelf.
It was nasty stick handling.
Beautiful.
It really was really good.
Beautiful.
I need a primer, though. I need some way to, because I know all season you're going to be after me to really learn to love this team. So give me some. I mean, everyone's everywhere. I don't even know where to look.
Well, that's exactly it. So you're used to a sport like football.
Yes,
where guys
I am.
Line up and they have a specific route they're going to run and they hike
and
the ball.
And then they do
and
that.
They go there and they throw the ball and that's the end of the play.
And there
then
are
everything
places
stops.
They aren't. Yes.
Right. So that's not what hockey is.
No,
hockey
it is not.
It's fluid and incredibly flexible in terms of you have basically three guys who are playing offense, two guys who are playing defense. And most of the time, the three guys playing offense are the ones in the offensive zone and the two defenders are back. But you can kind of switch it up. So if they see an opening, you might have a defender sneak up to try to make a run at the goal. You might have one of the offensive guys realize, I have to drop back and cover his back in case somebody gets by him. So you really should think about it as five guys who are just all moving in this fluid way as a team, trying to find the opening. And it's about movement. It's about getting the defense out of position. It's about, in that Pastrnak goal, you saw Pastrnak goes to the right of the goal. Krejci's coming up on the left side.
It was gorgeous.
So the goalie slides over to deal with Pastrnak. He dishes it back to Krejci. There's an opening in the top left corner. It's all about movement and seizing the moment. And the beautiful thing about hockey is it can turn on a dime. 19 and a half minutes of just absolute action back and forth. And then all of a sudden, one mistake, that's all the team is looking for.
Well, that happened with the Bruins in that game, right? It seems to be a pattern of theirs that they're behind or they're tied. And then last few minutes, all of a sudden, doink, 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 into the goal.
And it's what makes the playoff run so excruciating as a fan, because you're watching this and you go back and forth. It's a roller coaster in the truest sense. You think you have an offensive push, you're waiting to try to break through, and then all of a sudden it's going back the other way, and you have to scramble to get back on defense and not give up the backbreaking goal. So it at any moment can turn.
So last word on this, then we're going to go to something I know a little better, which is football. But you have said this is the team. This is the team that's going to make me love hockey and love the Bruins. Why?
I love this story. You said I was a jilted lover. I came in. I wasn't even able to really plug in for the first couple of weeks because it felt too raw and too painful coming off that Game 7 loss. Don't laugh at me.
I am.
It's real. My pain is real. So this is a young, exciting team. They've also got some core veteran guys who are basically kind of hitting the end of their career. You've got Chara, Krejci, Marchand, who are definitely on the downward slope. But then you also have David Pastrnak, who's maybe the best player in the NHL right now. He's 23 years old. He's leading the league in goals scored. It's a great mix of young, exciting talent with veteran guys who are trying to get one more title.
All right. Well, let's see how this goes.
It's going to be a fun ride.
I've told you I can't raise one eyebrow, but if I could, I would raise one eyebrow.
We're going to bring you on board. Don't worry.
All right. So we've got a couple minutes left, and I do want to move on to football, which I do understand and know much better, because the Pats lost to the Texans on Sunday night, and Chris, they lost.
Oh, yeah. That was bad.
Yeah,
that was,
so what
that
happened?
That was an ugly one. Well, I mean, it was just a bad game. They did not show up. And really, they struggled in all three phases. The offense looked bad. The defense maybe more surprisingly looked bad. And even the special teams looked bad. I think the key to point out here is this is the second mobile quarterback, the second quarterback they've played that can really kind of run around. A little bit different than Baltimore's Lamar Jackson, who runs first and kind of throws as a second option. Deshaun Watson, the Houston quarterback, he runs basically to get his receivers open and to create a play out of nothing. But they've struggled now with two mobile quarterbacks, and it's really concerning because they've got the Chiefs coming to town on Sunday. Patrick Mahomes, also a mobile quarterback.
So does that give the lie to the whole best defense ever for the Patriots?
It's too early to say, I think. It's possible. Their schedule, we talked about at the beginning of the year, was pretty soft. They didn't play a lot of great teams.
For a long time.
For a long time, the best game they had played was against the Bills. But I think we will see down the stretch here what happens to the defense. They have an incredibly talented secondary. Sunday's going to tell us a lot, to be honest, because this is a team that usually, late November, early December, has one game that makes you say, oh, is this the end of the run? Is this it for the dynasty? And then every time in the past, they've come back. So we'll see.
All right, so you talked about mobile quarterbacks. We should talk about the GOAT quarterback, Tom Brady. He's chewing receivers out on the field. Now, in all fairness, when it hits you in both hands, you got to catch it. But
yeah, it was really interesting because you saw very visually the frustration. He kind of tossed his helmet coming off the field at one point. He said, hey, guys, listen up. We have to be faster. You could read his lips. He was very emphatic. He's concerned about his young receivers. I just want to play the interception that he did throw because there is something interesting to point out about N'Keal Harry on this route.
There has never been anything settled with this passing game from the beginning of the year. And I talked about it before. Those inside routes are key.
34. Meanwhile, this is going to be picked off. Bradley Roby is going to set up a first and goal for the Texans.
So really interesting. I know, right? Really interesting there. You hear Collinsworth talking about the fact that they don't have anybody who can go across the middle and catch the ball the way they did when they had Gronk is kind of the unspoken thing there.
Right.
And N'Keal Harry is running a post. He's supposed to run up and cut to the middle. And he just gets basically pushed out of the way by the defensive back. And Brady is just coming to the bench and saying, you can't let that happen. You have to be better. You have to be stronger. You have to get open. And we'll see.
Okay, 10 seconds. What are you going to look for against Kansas City?
Really, I'm more interested in the defense. Kansas City doesn't have a great defense, so the offense should be okay. Let's see if the defense can slow down Kansas City's explosive attack. That'll tell us a lot, I think.
All right. That's Radio Boston's Chris Sidorick. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Sidorick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director with an assist today from Max. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Joining us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.